Chris Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nimmers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Welcome to Season 2, Episode 8 of Nailers Natter. This week I'll be in conversation with Ruth Walker. And Ruth and I will be discussing the concepts of powerful knowledge introduced by Professor Michael Young in his books Knowledge in the Future School, Bringing Knowledge Back In, and the seminal Knowledge and Control. And Ruth and I will be extremely fortunate in that we'll be interviewing Professor Young at Research Ed Rugby this Saturday on the 15th of June. So this natter was very timely ahead of that on the big day on Saturday. So without further ado, here is my interview with Ruth Walker. Okay, hello Ruth and welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Thank you very much for joining me during half term as well. So thank you very much for that.
Oh, well, thanks very much for having me. It's lovely.
No problem at all. Okay, as listeners will know, we're persisting with the X Factor question, regardless of the fact that the feedback isn't exactly positive. But we're going for it still. So if you could just bring us up to speed on your journey to this point and your current role.
Well, actually, I think to make a bit more sense of what we're perhaps going to talk about a bit later on, I think we have to start at the beginning, really. So the school that I went to was comprehensive, and I think it would be fair to say they had like quite bad behaviour and quite poor curriculum, and I didn't think much of it at the time, and now looking back I feel sort of like quite angry about it really, because you know I was all right in the end, but it was a massive waste of time, and you know lots of my peers weren't really all right in the end and missed out on you know all those opportunities that they could have had. So that was kind of where I started, but then I went to sixth form and it was just amazing. It was another world. It was like going to Hogwarts. You know, like we sat in rows and we listened to the teachers, and the teachers just knew loads and loads of stuff, and they taught it, explained it really well. And then I went to university and it was just the same thing, but like times a million. And there was just these, you know, incredibly clever people whose job it was to sort of like push the boundaries of human understanding. But then like their other job was to just teach like me and all the other 18-year-olds sort of fresh off the Ariba train. So, you know, it was just so wonderful to kind of have to use your brain and kind of like be supported in using your brain in that way. And then I graduated and I became a teacher. And, you know, like I've always really liked my job. And, you know, at the same time, it's always been a challenge. But actually, I didn't use my brain for 10 years after I graduated, not like in the way that you do sort of when you're at university. I never got that, like you might call it a rush that you get from really, really using your brain. And I thought that was just like, I thought that was just what happened. Like, I thought that was, you know, you got like your 3 years of wonderful experience at university and then you've just got your job. And if you're lucky, you like your job, but that's it in terms of using your brain. But then, sort of 3 years ago I started reading about teaching, so like Daisy Christodoulou and Dan Willingham, Aglimov, and that was when, you know, everything changed. Then everything switched on, I started making sense of everything, and so like I'd never really kind of been interested in leadership before, because it just looked to me like sort of trying to get people to do lots of things that didn't really make all that much sense. But then as soon as I started finding out about what really worked in education and how much, you know, the level of expectation that actually you could have, that was when I sort of wanted to begin, you know, start a leadership journey. So I applied for my job as lead practitioner at my current school, and that's where I am now. And yeah, I mean, it's just a really exciting time.
Wow, what a fantastic journey, and one that's echoed across quite a few of conversations that I'm having with teachers in terms of
how, you know, the early career that they had has now developed with, you know, sight of evidence, research, books, CPD, that kind of thing. So that's really, really interesting. Thank you for that. The one piece of research that you're going to talk about is going to be based on a book, I think. So could you tell us which book that is and maybe a little bit more about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the work of Michael Young and colleagues, in particular Johan Muller. So it's two books, kind of really, or perhaps three, but the main one is Knowledge in the Future School, and then the other one is Curriculum and the Specialisation of Knowledge. So there's a few key points that have like really come out of this research for me. One is, like, of course, this concept of powerful knowledge. So powerful knowledge is knowledge that takes children beyond their own experience and kind of like initiates them into the great conversations of humanity. And crucial to Young's sort of thesis is that this knowledge is the entitlement of all students, regardless of their background. So, like, this isn't really a new concept to me or you or probably, you know, lots of people in what you might call the knowledge movement. But I think Young and his colleagues do articulate it really well. But also there was a lot of points that were new to me. So first of all, there's this kind of like defence of the idea of best knowledge against there's a postmodernist objection to a knowledge curriculum, basically, or the idea of best knowledge. So Young and Muller defend best knowledge by invoking social realism. So basically, we are able to say there is best knowledge for the curriculum by basically asking the subject community what's the best knowledge. So, like, we're able to say that Shakespeare counts as best knowledge for literature because people in the subject community of literature broadly agree that Shakespeare is part of the best knowledge. And then there's like a related point that the what you'd call the disciplinary element of knowledge needs to be a part of the powerful knowledge curriculum. So, like, we can't just teach facts of science, like the substantive or the givens of science. Like, we also need to teach them about how science is produced and developed. So, for example, like the interplay between theory and experiment. And like that was really interesting for me because we've got this strand, haven't we, how science works in science, in the science curriculum. And it previously had been kind of like really annoying to me and just sort of seemed like a bit of a, like, why is it put in there? Is it just because like skills or something? But, you know, having read Young, I can see it now as like a crucial part of curriculum in a social realist standpoint. And then like the other really interesting thing that I've got from this research is sort of like the social and historical and philosophical background and context to where like the progressive sort of movement in education came from. So like I mentioned sort of the postmodernist objection to best knowledge and truth before, like that was a big movement in the universities and amongst intellectuals and teacher educators. But what I didn't realise was that at the same time, compulsory education up to 16 for all students came into play. And so all at once, there was this massive influx of young people into the education system who, you know, came from less advantaged backgrounds than the people who had studied education previously. And they were kind of, you know, these children were, on the face of it at least, seemed to be less likely to engage with the traditional curriculum. So it's almost like there's a kind of, you know, you might call it like a perfect storm of factors that led to the very successful and enduring progressive agenda.
Absolutely. I mean, as you know, we've exchanged a few messages in the run-up to this podcast. I have been reading some of Young's work. I was familiar with it previously, but I've been reading it particularly recently because, as listeners will know, and I've mentioned it on previous podcasts, I'm going to be extremely fortunate enough to be able to interview with you, Ruth. With you.
I'm so excited.
That's confirmed now.
Please could just be tomorrow, honestly. I can't wait any longer.
Absolutely. At Research Ed Rugby. So and I tended to see some of the work through the prism of sort of my day-to-day experiences of teaching, you know, pupils science in classrooms. And And one thing that struck me is kind of the social justice angle behind powerful knowledge and how we can kind of sometimes use the labels. I'm not suggesting that you use these or that I use these, but these are bandied around, that sort of less able, unmotivated students wouldn't be able to cope with the demands of powerful knowledge. And sometimes that's restricted curriculum choices for more sort of vocational-based qualifications.
Yeah, not
denigrating them in any way, and I have taught those in the past. But, you know, what's your thoughts around sort of science curriculum, powerful knowledge, and access to that, really, for everybody, particularly at Key Stage 4?
Yeah, I think this is such an interesting thing, and I think, you know, one of the issues around Young's work on powerful knowledge is that, like, what we'd really like is a list of what subjects and what qualifications count as powerful knowledge and what don't. And of course, no one's provided that, and it's quite a controversial thing to sort of try and do. But I mean, I think at least what powerful knowledge does allow us to do is to say, okay, well, that's not powerful knowledge. You know, we might not be able to agree on like a complete list, but we can certainly look at certain things and say, no, actually, that's not powerful knowledge. So, like, we had a student several years ago at my old school, and she got to year 11, and she was a bit sort of wayward, and then she sorted herself out, and then in year 11 she wanted to go and study science A levels, and we put her on UTEC, so she wasn't able to go and do science A levels. And I think, you know, that as a criterion, you know, there are several criteria for demarcating something as powerful knowledge, and I think that one, certainly, like, you know, if a qualification means that you're not going to be able to go and pursue this in further study, then it's not counted as powerful knowledge.
No, absolutely. I mean, one thing that struck me was that he also talked about this idea that pupils don't come to school to have more experience of everyday life.
Yeah.
You know, they've got plenty of that, and that sometimes could have been an accusation levelled at some previous science curriculum, certainly that I've taught very early in the career. Just to move it on, Ruth, if I might do slightly, and I'm going slightly off topic in terms of the questions, but I just wondered what your thoughts as a physicist were on this. So, you know, in this powerful knowledge model, then what do you see as the role of subject specialists within that? And is it important in your view that the scientific disciplines are taught by subject specialists?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I think science. I think subject specialism has to be, you know, sort of top of the agenda in terms of teachers engaging with subject knowledge and, you know, constantly improving their subject knowledge. You know, and I think that the subject associations are really, really key here. I think, you know, you also have to be realistic about, you know, what you're going to get in terms of your staffing. We've got one physics specialist at my school, and that's me. And I guess my question would be, what action can we take to make sure that students get, you know, their entitlement in terms of powerful knowledge, and that we make the best use of the subject specialists that we've got? So, like, you know, I think that, you know, one of the things that we do in my school is we free up a lot of teacher time. Like, we have centralised attentions, we don't have any written reports. So, you know, our time as subject specialists is very much freed up so that we can go and write quality. You know, we're using a booklet model at the moment, you know, quality booklets, quality explanations, so that, you know, even if you've got non-specialists, that the children have a guarantee, you know, like a minimum guarantee of that powerful knowledge entitlement, really.
No, that's interesting, really interesting. Again, seeing these things through the sort of the prism of your own experience, I've looked at, this is probably the first time that I've solely taught biology to GCSE classes this year. I've been very lucky that I've been able to do that. And I feel, but this is only my feeling at this stage, and we're talking before biology paper two, so that it's been, you know, I feel like I've been more effective. Now, that's obviously, you know, correlation, causation, and just me speculating about that.
Yeah.
But it's been very interesting. And also, you'll have read, no doubt, both the Gatsby report and the EEF's report.
Yeah.
And subject knowledge was flagged in the Gatsby report in terms of its importance there, but it didn't feature really within the guidance for the EEF secondary science. It is mentioned that subject knowledge underpins all of the other principles. But it's interesting because we have to be pragmatic about the fact that, that there aren't a surplus of particularly physics teachers to go around.
Yeah,
and it's quite difficult.
I agree. Hmm. Yeah, definitely. I'm just sort of reflecting on my answer before. And I think that thinking longer term, actually, you know, okay, we don't have a surplus of physics teachers now, but, you know, all the sort of physics graduates or most of the physics graduates who I know who sort of eschew teaching do so because they don't think it would be interesting enough or intellectual enough, and they don't want to kind of sort of hang around, like, you know, doing stupid things and not using their brain. And so, like, that's them kind of reacting against the model that I was sort of laboring under for the 10 years that I mentioned. I guess what I'm trying to say is, if we pursue powerful knowledge, could an unintended but very significant benefit be that, you know, the profession becomes intellectualized and we are able to recruit a lot more subject specialists than we currently are?
It's a great point. It really is. And if I look at the journey that I've been on, certainly, you know, people who've known me or worked with me for the past, well, I'm trying to think now, nearly 20 years, even in the last couple of years, I've started to take the subject knowledge aspect alongside the pedagogy much more seriously. And that sounds terrible. Not suggest that I wasn't before, but it, you know, my own professional development, you know, I'm pursuing a master's unsuccessfully at the moment. But you talk about intellectualizing it, and there was this kind of movement previously, you know, in science teaching and wider, that good teachers can teach anything, which I guess to a certain extent might, you know, might apply, but not in the depth that Jung's talking about, and not with the powerful knowledge that will be required, and that sort of pedagogic content knowledge. Even it would be difficult to do that without the basis of subject knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely agree.
Brilliant. Okay, so just back onto the questions. Obviously, you've talked about when you read it. Was there a particular way that you've used this research in your job?
So I'm leading on curriculum reform across the whole school, and you know, Jung's ideas have just been really helpful. In one of the things, like, I really wanted to do was sort of articulate, like, the moral imperative, because for me, this whole curriculum thing is an ethical issue really at heart. And I think that if you can convince people of the moral imperative, if you like, for an ambitious, powerful knowledge curriculum for all, then I think you've got a large part of your culture in the workplace pretty sorted. Like, you've shared your vision, if you like. And the other thing that's been really useful is, like, the historical context stuff I mentioned. Like, I think it's really hard for people, you know, most staff in schools now have been working for 10, 15, 20 years under this paradigm of kind of, you know, lower expectations, or this kid's got a target grade of a 2, so we won't, you know, he can't do balancing equations, or, you know, is this really suitable for kids from this estate? And it's all really well intentioned, isn't it? But, you know, I think that hearing about the historical context and the idea that this, you know, this culture of low expectations was and still is, like, a national issue. I think that's helpful for people to have it sort of maybe framed, if you like, in that way. And, you know, and then, because the message is that, you know, this was happening nationally, but now we know that, you know, we can expect more, and that students should be entitled to this powerful knowledge. You know, like, the path of history is changing, and we can be part of that. We can fight for a powerful knowledge curriculum for all. I think that's helpful for staff to hear it in that way.
No, definitely. And again, I was just thinking, finding myself agreeing there in terms of, you know, I've talked about the classes that maybe wouldn't traditionally have taken a triple award science qualification, for example, and engaging with that sort of powerful knowledge, would have traditionally had more of a curriculum that was seen to, and lessons as well, that were seen to be, well, make sure you appeal to their interests, you know, make sure you reflect in their experiences. And it goes back to what Jung is talking about, that they're not coming to school for more of their experiences. They're going to get those outside of school. And it's that agreed of, you know, powerful knowledge for all, for social justice is really quite powerful, and you articulate it really well there in terms of curriculum. And now is a good time to be talking about that in terms of lots of people looking at redesigning curriculums. I'd like to say not just because of Ofsted, but I feel that that might be the case.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I welcome the focus from Ofsted. You know, it's certainly one of the, it's been one of the driving factors, you know, I think in my school for encouraging leadership to look at it. But, you know, the conversations that are flowing from that focus are, they're good conversations, you know, they're intellectual, they're professional, they're motivated by, you know, like you say, social justice. It's not, you know, in the past I've kind of been part of conversations about like, oh yeah, this will be great for Ofsted, and they were just really soul destroying, you know, depressing, progress in 20 minutes, target grades on the front of books, all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And this feels really, really different. But just going back to what you talked about with the you know, with the sort of the powerful knowledge of lifting students beyond their own experiences, I think that's everything really, just in that one little phrase. And I think you know, Daniel Mears talked about something very similar at Research Ed Birmingham, when he talked about the tyranny of the algorithm, and if you just input students' experiences, then the output will just be the same, and you just kind of have like a vicious feedback loop. And nobody is ever taken beyond their own experience. And I think that's a really powerful sort of metaphor there.
Absolutely. And Daniel was on with us recently, as you'll know. He was on at Research at Blackpool, and he talked to us at length. And, you know, I agree with you. A lot of the work that certainly Daniel's doing behind the scenes, and I've heard Amanda Spielman talk as well in terms of the intent of the curriculum, lots and lots of good things coming out of Ofsted.
Agreed.
My fear, and I've been talking to Mark Enter this afternoon about this, my fear is that a surface understanding, and it's really important that what you've said there, that the conversations that are flowing from that are intellectual, and they are designed, you know, what we might be finding in some cases is that as teachers and leaders don't have the time, we're seeing a surface understanding of some concepts, you know, whether it be around cognitive science, which I know is one of your fields as well, and curriculum, and we end up with, if we're not careful, a surface level implementation with, you know, a very limited understanding, which can then, you know, cause teachers to lose confidence in what are essentially, you know, really important concepts, particularly the one we're talking about today.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that actually as an unintended consequence. I mean, my initial response would have been, okay, but even when they are a surface level conversation, it's still a better conversation than not talking about curriculum, not talking about entitlement. You know, and so I would stand by that. And I guess sort of particularly with the cog sci stuff and you know, yeah, you can just imagine kind of, you know, one hears the sort of people doing interleaving, sort of like one lesson on one topic and then the next lesson on a completely different topic and darting around all over the place like that as like an example of sort of like a lethal mutation or something of, you know, born of a poor understanding, like a surface level understanding like you described. So, but I mean, yeah, you know, I guess like things, people just need to listen to your podcast, for example, and we just need to carry on, you know, putting the message out there, blogging, tweeting and talking to people and getting as many people switched on as we can.
Absolutely. And again, that was the reason for the podcast, to try and, you know, give people an opportunity to have a bit more of an understanding from a classroom perspective on these things. And you can listen to them hopefully on the drive to work or while you're walking the dog or whatever it is that people are doing while they're listening to that. So that's really important. Okay, Ruth, I'm just looking at moving it on slightly. So in terms of sharing this research, now, can I ask you about a couple of things? So I know that you've shared this through your blog. I know that you've also shared this, and I think as we speak today, and I'm not sure what day it is because it's one of those where it's half term. So is it Tuesday today?
I think so.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? But I believe you've got an article for the TES on Friday where you're also talking about curriculum, and you're going to be talking about it at Research Ed conferences coming up. So can you just talk a little bit about what kind of things you're sharing through those different outlets?
Yeah, I mean, the TES article is just a very quick piece just on how we've been looking at powerful knowledge within our science department this year. Research Ed, I'll be presenting on basically this podcast, but sort of talking a bit more about like the philosophical, historical, social background, and talking about as well, like I like practical things. I like top tips that you can pick up and go and do, you know, today. So, you know, there's a list of things that I think we should all be doing to kind of fight for powerful knowledge for all. And also I'm going to be talking about, you know, some of the detail of how we have been leading curriculum reform in my school.
Brilliant. And I think that this is another example of what you've talked about before, of how important it is to get these messages out via the various outlets that we've talked about. I talked to Mark Enter before about TES in terms of what I determined to be a shift in terms of even how they're presenting the information.
Yes.
And, you know, you could argue they're putting across some more powerful knowledge. I know lots of people are returning to that publication particularly. Lots of people are now reading that previously probably rested their coffee on it on the staff room table before. And obviously publications that are coming out of Impact and the Chartered College, that sort of thing, have been useful for teachers to kind of get a handle on research and evidence-based practice.
Yeah, I think that's, I feel really optimistic about it, to be fair. You know, when I've got colleagues switched on to Twitter, you know, they come in every day and just say, you know, bloody hell, I love Twitter, it's amazing, like it's changed my life. Because it's not, you know, this stuff actually makes sense. Like it's actually, it tells you why things that you always had a sneaking suspicion you didn't like, or they didn't work. Like it makes sense of all those hunches that you had. So it's not like all the other kind of sort of pedagogy stuff that was around previously. It, you know, once it clicks, it really does click, and I think people will really run with it.
Definitely. Can I just ask you about your blog? So, as I said, we're recording this on what I think is a Tuesday, and you had a new blog post out last night, which unfortunately I haven't had a chance to read, but I did read the one before. So, your plan to reform our curriculum, and I love this quote, and I hope I've got this right. You put a quote and said, "Curriculum is my king and country." I love that.
Oh yeah, that's me. So curriculum is my country.
Brilliant. Can you just tell us, listeners, where they can find your blog? And what kind of things you're talking about?
Yeah, so it's www.rosalindwalker.wordpress.com. And yeah, it's a mixture of things, really. When I started blogging, I was sort of responding to some conversations about behaviour that I'd seen on Twitter. So there's some interesting stuff, actually, on how we implemented a new behaviour system in my previous school with, you know, an incredible turnaround in a matter of weeks. It was just phenomenal. And then there's bits on sort of science teaching and physics teaching and SLOP, so shed loads of practice. And then more recently, I've been looking at curriculum planning and sort of within science and also more broadly across whole school.
Brilliant. Okay, so just looking at the time, so I like to keep it to around about half an hour, like I said, so that listeners can have the commute there or the dog walk, whatever it is. So I've just got one more thing to say and possibly one more question to finish off with. The thing I'd like to say, my science department would not forgive me if I didn't say a massive thank you to you for all the work that you've done. The number of times that your work or Pritesh's work or various others have been discussed at our science department meetings is unbelievable. And the SLOP resources that you talked about there, they have been used regularly. And all of our science departments are huge fans of everything you do in terms of cognitive science. And I know that they were all at your talk at Research at Blackpool and Pritesh's talk at Research at Blackpool as well. So just to say thank you for all the work that you're doing there. It's really appreciated, and it's really connecting with science teachers.
Oh, that's brilliant. No, thank you so much for the feedback. And I'm a bit embarrassed about the SLOP books, it's actually, to be fair. Like, I wrote them, you know, I've done a lot of thinking before, you know, since I wrote those. So I'm hoping to update them over the summer holidays. So I'm glad they're useful, but, you know, don't judge me if there's any mistakes or if they don't really apply the principles of cognitive load theory very accurately, then, yeah, don't judge me.
No, we absolutely won't. And like I said, it's a regular conversation at our science department. Our science department's, you know, quite forward thinking in terms of evidence and research, and I cannot take any credit for this. And if any of them are listening, they won't be listening, because the last thing they want to hear is me again. And then it's enough to hear me every day of the week. They really don't want to hear me in an evening. But they've really taken that the work that you've done, and they've really moved that forward, and lots of the things that they're doing are fantastic, and it's making a real difference for the pupils. So if I just finish with one last question, if that's okay. So in terms of sort of a call to action, so if you're somebody who's listening to this podcast and who hasn't read, and I can't believe there's many people, but hasn't read any of Professor Michael Young's work, you know, where would you direct them, and, you know, why should they read it?
Well, there's a, if you don't want to read the whole book, there's, I mean, the book, the one book, the Knowledge in the Future School is really accessible. I really recommend it. If you don't want to read the whole book, there's a paper that's free to download. It's called The Curriculum and the Entitlement to Knowledge. And why should you read it? Like, I think if you want like a banner for ambitious curriculum and a knowledge-centered approach, or if you feel these, you know, if you feel a part of this movement, but you want a beautiful articulation of our vision, if you want to understand more about the social and historical context so that you can make the message really land with people who, you know, who might struggle with it a bit, you know, and if you're feeling angry about any time that you've wasted or any children that have been let down by low expectations in the past, then, I'd strongly recommend you read it.
Fantastic. And a great summary there. Right, Ruth, thank you very much for your time, particularly on half term. And I'm very, very much looking forward to interviewing Professor Michael Young. Well, you interviewing him and me just kind of sitting there and throwing bits in as and when I understand what both of you are talking about.
I honestly can't wait. I hope that I can speak when we have the interview, because he's just my idol.
I'm sure we will be able to. And I'm really, really looking forward to Research Ed Rugby altogether, and particularly that talk. So thanks again, Ruth. Really appreciate your time. Thank you very much for speaking to me.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to my dad on the podcast called Nailers Natter. Follow him on Twitter at PNA1977.
One of my favourite interviews there with Ruth. Really enjoyed speaking to her, and we have so many shared experiences of powerful knowledge within science and wider across the school. And I'm really looking forward to her becoming my co-host for the Research Ed Rugby special with Professor Michael Young. So in the next few episodes, I will be speaking to Jonathan Haslam, the Director of the Institute for Effective Education, on promising research projects, and Mark McCourt on mastery. And into the shameless plugs section, so as mentioned a few times already, on this Saturday the 15th of June, I'll be at Research Ed Rugby talking about escaping the hamster wheel, using research and evidence to change culture in schools, and the aforementioned live Nailers Natter with Professor Michael Young. On the 28th of June, I'll be in London talking about metacognition in a knowledge-rich curriculum for Keynote. And if you enjoy the podcast, then please like and subscribe. And I'd like to get a new feature where listeners send in questions for upcoming guests. So if you can click on the link on the podcast introduction. And it remains for me to say once again, thank you for listening, and see you next time on Nailers Natter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.